I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
Welcome to this episode of The Trade Guys. This is Trade Guy Scott. Bill and I spend the podcast discussing 2024 and the implications of trade in an election year, both in the United States and around the world. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Trade Guys. Happy New Year. Hope the break went well for you. Any year that starts with 2020 makes me feel like it should be happening in the future. Certainly not now, but here we are. So just as we reflected back on what happened throughout 2023, at the end of 2023, we're going to think about what will happen or what may happen in 2024. I hope you brought your crystal balls.
I brought my magic eight ball. Yeah, one of those.
Probably as reliable as any other political forecast at this time of the year. So
I think so. I mean, it produces these things, wonderful answers like time will tell, or maybe, or, you know, we'll see. I'm moderately, I'm sort of gloomy. I'm actually, the one area where I might be a little bit optimistic, which we'll get to a little bit later, is, believe it or not, it's the WTO and MC13. I hope they'll pull a rabbit out of the hat, but for the rest of it, I confess to some gloom. You know, here in Washington, we've moved firmly into election cycle. Scott can speak to the election cycle in North Carolina, but here it's all about the election. And I think what that means immediately is that not much is going to happen on trade, except in the sense of demagoguery from everybody about it's good, it's bad. The administration is doing it right. The administration is doing it wrong. Trump, of course, will have his own view about trade, and he will, as he's done the last two elections, make it a prime topic. But again, in the demagoguery proposal area, not in terms of concrete accomplishments, I think what we've discovered is that, we'll get to looking forward on IPEF too, but I think what we've discovered is that they've kind of at least temporarily run out of gas on a lot of things, the administration. And so I don't look for innovation. Take seriously what I've said often on the podcast, that USTRs get judged by what they finish, not by what they start. And this is the finishing year. So because you don't know if you're going to get a new lease on life after November. So I look for them to try to finish things. But the reality is they haven't finished very much. And I'm not really all that confident they're going to finish much more. Scott, are you?
Well, yeah, I think I would start the year by bidding a not particularly fond farewell to worker-centered trade policy. Now, I frankly have never really understood that, and it confused me in the same way that I think it was during President Obama's second term. He started talking about economic growth from the middle out, and that was at least wrapped in some Keynesian ideas about consumption. But never really clear what it meant. It was a nice way to criticize the 1%. With worker-centered trade policies, I don't know that it means anything, because one of the things that is true in the past 3 years of the Biden administration is that the terms of trade have not changed at all for almost anything in that period of time. So there's no way to look at a policy change and say, well, that's worker-centered economics, and then be able to measure how it worked. What we've had for 3 years is basically Trump 1.1. All the tariffs that were in place when President Trump left office and President Biden took office are still there. We still have the Section 301. We still have the Section 232 tariffs. There's lots of retaliation from our trading partners. So nothing's really changed, and that I think is. Was a contributor to the agenda running aground the way it did at the meetings in San Francisco. So maybe we just need a better idea, but I'm confused by this
one. Once again, I think Scott is attempting to elevate the discussion by talking about substance and principle and policy. While I'm going to talk about politics, I'm sort of in the same place for a different reason. I think their policies run aground because it turned out not to produce the political effect they wanted. I think the idea was from the beginning, let's produce, if we have to have a trade policy, and I think some of them would prefer not to, but if we have to have a trade policy, let's produce one that doesn't irritate our left wing, like TPP did and like all the other trade agreements have done. So we've developed this narrative, which Scott just obliterated, which is a trade policy for the workers. I think what we learned late in 2023 was that despite the intention, which is to develop a trade policy to the workers, they were never able to sell it to the workers. And what you had was the left wing, and Senator Sherrod Brown in particular, standing up and saying, not good enough, or not good enough for me, not good enough for us. And the consequence of that was that they pulled back, and now they really don't have very much, at least on the trade front. This is kind of ironic. You know, people who've been listening to this for a long time may recall back when IPEF was launched, I think I made the point that while it was characterized as here as not TPP and therefore intrinsically better, progressive groups in the other countries put out press releases that said, don't be fooled. You know, it's TPP in disguise. And what we are now learning is that that never went away. And now you've got people in the United States, beginning with Trump, who said the same thing. Don't be fooled. It's really, you know, TPP 2.0. And now you've got Democrats on the left saying the same thing. Don't be fooled. You know, this is just a retread. And there's not really anything here for workers. I mean, that's demonstrably incorrect. The two negotiations and the prospective agreements are very different. But as somebody said actually it was Gavin Bade in Politico, if you don't get political, quoting anonymous Democrats as saying, this is the question of perception, not reality. And people perceive it as being a bad deal, that is IPEF, and that is not good for workers. And so it's been abandoned. So I'm depressed to report that you know, their effort to carve out a new policy seems not to have worked. And their response, rather than going ahead with it, has been basically to cave. And I'm kind of sad about that.
Well, look, Senator Brown has, there's a reason he's never lost an election. And he's actually quite effective as a politician. And I think he's done what's right for him in this circumstance. Having said that, look, I'm old enough to remember when the Democrats cared about our farm policy and farm trade. Which, you know, I do understand that the party has different constituencies, but though the constituencies on the ballot this fall, some of them are being ignored. But for me, there's a bigger problem, which is the, I mean, I know they're worried about Trump, and I know the Trump trade rhetoric is very effective for his base. Frankly, we criticized Tariff Man a lot on this program when he was president because the tariffs were bad for the economy. I mean, it's a very simple reason. And you can demonstrate pretty easily, you know, with particularly the steel and aluminum tariffs that came on in mid-2018. And you can watch manufacturing output drop starting the fourth quarter of 2018. And it never recovered. All right. Nobody ever took on whether these tariffs that were in place were a good or bad idea. Therefore, they conceded the argument totally. And I don't understand for the life of me. Even if you want some of them, you didn't make an argument that any of this was bad for the economy when it was demonstrably bad for the economy. So there you have it.
You guys are making my job very easy because we're hitting a lot of the points that I think a lot of people think are going to be important in 2024. And Bill, I wanted to come back to something you said a bit earlier on about the WTO. And can we talk a little bit more about that? What's happening with the WTO? What can we expect, especially from MC13?
Well, as always, it will not only go down to the wire, it will probably go past the wire. That's the record of ministerial conferences. They're scheduled to end on a specific day, and they usually end up going 1, 2, or 3 days beyond that. That is painful for the people that are there because it means round-the-clock negotiating sessions, exhausted people, lots and lots of coffee, lots and lots of pizza, although this will be in Abu Dhabi. I'm not sure that Pizza is the biggest thing there, but lots and lots of hummus. But that's a good sign. You know, if it runs over, it means that they're approaching a deal. And I continue to try to be optimistic. They've put in a lot of work on fish to try to get beyond the first tranche of the fisheries agreement that was approved in the last conference. There are significant differences left, basically thanks to India, that wants an extended, I think, something like 25-year phase-in period, which is outrageous. But I think they're slowly moving in the direction of producing something. There are trade-offs. India has an agenda, a positive agenda, which is good because it means that there's an opportunity there for some dealing. You give us what we want, we'll think about giving you what you want or some part of what you want. So I think they may pull something out on fish. I think they'll set up a work program on agriculture. A work program is basically a code for, we can't agree on anything, so we'll agree to have a plan for having another year of talking about it. But they haven't even been able to do that for the last several years. So if they could agree on sort of parameters and agriculture topics at a framework, that would be a modest but still a step forward. I also think they may actually produce something on reform. The U.S. has maintained that the MC-12 commitment to produce WTO reform in 2024 means by the end of the year. Everybody else thinks it means by MC-13, which is the end of February. So we'll see. My guess is that if the United States is smart, this may be an area where they should take yes for an answer, because I think they're going to get a good bit of what they want in terms of WTO reform. They haven't been very clear about exactly what they want, but the proposals that are on the table from other parties over the last couple of years have gone significantly in the direction of what the U.S. wants. So I think there's an opportunity there to put something together. I think dealing with the appellate body may be the harder. The United States is going to have to be smoked out on that, and will actually have to declare whether it is willing to have one or not. And I have my doubts about that, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility of that. I mean, you have to remember the last time around, they went into it in semi-disarray and post-COVID disarray, and they managed to pull out two multilateral things on fisheries and on vaccines, you know, both modest, but the first multilateral agreements since 2015. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility that they may do it again. They're certainly spending the time on it. They're certainly putting in the work on it. And they seem to have chairpersons of the various groups that are both committed and competent.
Well, I wish them all the luck in the world. Look, I've said it before on this program that the World Trade Organization is not so much an organization as a table. It's a bargaining table. And it's a place where things happen when the big traders are ready to deal, ready to make something happen. I'm not sure that's the case here, but I'll take any progress that's available. And frankly, I'm all for the fish negotiations, mostly because, well, it's important to do, because overfishing is a real problem. But it also is a classic problem of the commons that is like every other climate problem. And you don't have to win a debate about climate to know that it's physically possible to remove every single fish from the ocean if we wanted to. We have the technology. So progress here, progress in fish, creates a structure that can be reapplied to other similar problems of commons. So I wish them all the luck. I hope it works out. I hope somebody is representing the interests of what's the largest and most innovative and productive sector of the economy, which is technology. I'm not sure that's the Biden administration, but we'll see what gets tabled and what the issues are.
Guys, let's switch gears and look at some trading relationships that are particularly important for the United States. And obviously, one of the defining features of foreign policy this year is going to be the direction of the U.S.-China relationship. How are you guys thinking about U.S.-China trade in 2024?
It's one of a reluctant need on both parties. I mean, I get the idea that we'd rather not do it, but we have no options. So it's going to continue on much as it has, despite all the talk about friendshoring and de-risking the supply chains. Exports from China continue to be fairly important to the U.S. economy. And China's imports from the United States are fairly important to the U.S. economy. I don't know if there's a substitute for that given the size. I think China has a fair number of economic headwinds to get through, as does the United States. So I think overall, we are likely to become about as pragmatic as we've been. And I think keeping expectations low for anything beyond pure pragmatism is probably asking for too much.
Lots of rhetoric, but I don't think much change in policy. And I agree with Scott on that. I think the rhetoric will come certainly from Trump, who apparently is already talking about, you know, totally decoupling from China and banning all their imports. How he could manage to do that eludes me, but that apparently is on the agenda. Phase in, so not all at once. And if he suggests that, along with his sort of global tariff increase of whatever it is, 10% or whatever he ends up with, you know, that's going to suck up a lot of the trade discussion oxygen over the next year, because the Biden folks will have to respond to that, and they're going to have to say it's a good idea or it's a bad idea, or what they're going to do instead if they think it's a bad idea. And so we're going to end up debating China kind of fruitlessly, because I think the Biden folks are right in their conclusion that there's really nothing that we're going to be able to do that will change China's economic behavior. We've tried a lot of things. Trump tried a lot of things. None of them work. China's going to do what's good for China. And what's good for China is continuing to steal our IP and continue to subsidize and try to outcompete us every which way they can, legal and illegal. And I think the Biden folks have got it right in realizing that we have to resist and we have to fight back, particularly on illegal actions. But the biggest thing we need to do is run faster to make sure that we are going to be a more effective competitor. Trump is still going to be focused on the hit them in the face and keep hitting them in the face until they fall over strategy. Let's, you know, stop taking their imports, and you know, that'll hurt them. And I think the reality is, Scott can explain better than I, is it'll probably hurt us more than them. Their trade with us is still very, very large, but it's declining. And they're not dummies. They've figured out what's going on here. And they're spending a lot of time trying to grow their market share elsewhere. And they're going to continue to do that. And the real issue is we're going to be competing against them in those other places, in Latin America, in Africa, in the Middle East, in India, in Europe. We need to sharpen our competitive skills. If we just focus on trying to keep them out of our market, which is what Trump is going to say, A, we're not going to succeed in doing that. B, it's going to cost us an enormous amount of decline of economic growth. And C, it misses the point, because the point is what's happening everywhere else.
Another important relationship where we can feel, for better or worse, the influence of Donald Trump is evidently the transatlantic relationship. And we have elections going on this year, and the EU has elections going on this year. What are your prospects for US-EU trade?
US-EU. Well, that's been on the news lately. There's been a lot of discussion about it because of the failure, another failure, to reach an agreement on the steel and aluminum tariff issue in November, when Ursula von der Leyen and was here and Charles Michel were here in town. What they did is exactly what the trade guys predicted they would do, which is kick the can. And they kicked the can a little bit longer than I thought. The Europeans have said they won't go back to the tariffs until March of 2025. I think I'm gathered the Biden people have said a little bit longer than that. They had a two-year kick of the can. Either way, it gets us past both elections, theirs and ours. But I think discussions will continue. I think people right now are pessimistic. To the extent that anybody is optimistic, it's been actually Dan Mullaney, our old friend, who used to be the assistant USTR for Europe and the Middle East until he retired a year ago. And he continues to speak on the topic. And he said something very interesting the other day, which was he thought the good news in the relationship was that we were talking less and less about the things that divide us mutual trade barriers, our inability to do things there, their inability to do things here, which we've been talking about for 40 years without much success. And that we were talking more and more about common challenges that we face together, mainly China, but that's not the only one. The climate challenge is another one. And that he thought that might lead to more productive outcomes. If we can talk together about problems that are the same for both of us or similar for both of us, it makes it easier to reach an agreement on those things. And it's a positive move. It doesn't involve really one side surrendering to the other and taking a political hit. It involves both sides cooperating. So that may happen, although I have to say the near-term signs for that are not good. They've still not scheduled the next meeting of the Trade and Technology Council. They've been following a Europe in the spring, U.S. in the fall script for a couple of years. They didn't do it in the fall in the U.S., and they've not scheduled one now, even though it's past the fall. So I'm a little worried about where that's going. I think when we talked about this before, I mentioned that my colleague, Emily Benson, said they gave the whole thing six meetings and thought it would fade off into the sunset after that. I think so far we've had four or five. So we're
right on schedule.
Right on schedule. Yes, it's beginning to fade away. So Dan may be right about the change of tone of the conversation, but I don't see a lot of concrete results right now. They couldn't close on the steel aluminum agreement. They haven't been able to close on critical minerals. Our companies are upset because our government is not pressing the Europeans hard enough on areas where we diverge, digital trade being the biggest one. There's some other landmark issues coming down the EU regulatory funnel at the commission level on reporting, due diligence, reporting requirements, ESG reporting requirements, things like that, that business here is not going to be happy about. I suspect business there is not going to be happy about either, which means it may not happen anytime soon.
Well, Bill, I think you just put your finger on the issue, which is the commercial value of the agenda is shrinking. I mean, I'm glad they're talking about things they agree on and not things they disagree on, but What's the commercial impact of the things they agree on? It's sort of far into the future. Meanwhile, we're ignoring things that are immediate frictions right at the moment, whether it's in digital trade or regulation or censorship or wherever the things are surfacing and causing a lot of difficulty and complexity. Those have real commercial value this week. I don't know who's interested in the long run agenda. I guess we'll figure that out, but.
I think it will continue to be kind of a fraught discussion. What will be interesting to me to see is, since we both have elections this year, the extent to which this becomes an election year issue. And right now, it doesn't look like, while it looks like trade will be a whipping boy, at least in the United States, thanks to Trump, you know, his favorite victims tend not to be European. He's railed in the past about Germany. And I mean, Scott was the first one, I think, to make this point, and it was really an eye-opener for me. I hadn't thought about it, but he made the point early on that what Trump was doing was focusing precisely on the countries with which we have the biggest deficits. So there was method to the madness. One of those was Germany, and people pointed out, of course, that you have to look at the EU as a whole, not as a single country, not as single countries.
Which did about as much good as pointing anything out to Donald J. Trump has done.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I think a lot of his focus is going to be on, again, probably Canada, Mexico, and Asia, particularly China. And, you know, Europe, maybe not. I mean, his European focus was on NATO and getting them to pay more. It wasn't entirely on trade. So the trade debate here may not focus too much on Europe. And I'm not sure the debate in the European Parliament elections is going to focus all that much on the United States. Maybe it will. We'll see. But it hasn't really done that so far. I think and this is where Dan has a point, they have to contend with the China challenge just as we do. And for them, in some areas like electric vehicles, it's much more immediate than it is for us. They're getting a lot of imports right now, which is a huge challenge to their auto industry, which is mostly German and French, but not entirely. And they've got, you know, a lot more in the way of waves of Chinese imports to deal with. So I think they've got other things on their mind besides us.
Guys, thank you for sharing your outlook. We'll see what this year has in store for us. One thing's for sure is it will have material for the trade guys. That's at least one thing to be optimistic about. So I'll see you next week.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to the Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.